acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 55, Mellowing Agents, Sunday, September 28th, 2014. I'm your host, Sarah, and I'm podcasting from the banks of the Delaware River again this morning. The fall weather just continues to beckon me outside. Eventually, I will return to my indoor recording studio. But for now, I hope you will enjoy the ambient sounds that will no doubt occur in this recording. It's a cool and overcast fall morning here in the Poconos. I don't think we're going to have a very brilliant fall foliage season. The weather has been extremely dry in August and September. We've had some rain recently, but it's not enough to help nature recover from such a dry late summer season. Most of the leaves are just turning brown and brittle before they fall off the trees. There are some pops of color, but it's not going to be a very pretty fall season, I don't think. This episode will include announcements for the Asymmetrical Craft Along winners, and it will also include the following segments: Ever Expanding Skill Set, Yarn Lover at Large, and Double Happiness. Welcome to E.O. Tinks, who is Elise from Kansas. She introduced herself on the welcome thread on Ravelry. And as of this recording on Sunday morning, the Ravelry group for Yarns at Yin Hu has 300 members. Thank you to everyone who has joined. If you haven't already, join in the Ravelry group, introduce yourself on the welcome board, and check out opportunities to win some pretty swell prizes. Right now, there's a contest open for a copy of Laura Nelkin's Knockout Knits. It's a signed copy. An interview with Laura was featured in episode 54, Destination Rooftop. So give that a listen if you haven't already. And the contest for the book will continue until the next episode, which I'll record maybe in a week or so, and I will draw for the winner on episode 56. You can find me as Sarah Pomegranate on social media like Ravelry, Twitter, and Instagram. And the Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a website, yarnsatyinhu.com. It also has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. The Asymmetrical Craft Along, was my first endeavor to host a craft along, knit along on the podcast. And I was just truly gratified by the participation and the interest in this craft along. So I'd like to thank everyone who participated. I'd like to recognize again Simone Eich of Woolwork Designs, who contributed 5 pattern prizes much earlier in this craft along. And I'd also like to recognize again all of the folks who contributed prizes, and I will restate that information as I draw each prize. The first winner is Quilt and Knit Nut for post number 26 of the Herringbone Boomerang Shawl. And Quilt and Knit Nut wins a skein of fingering weight yarn in the Tokyo Nightclub colorway, contributed by Patrizia of BZB Fibers. Second winner for post number 30 is Pocketses for a trillion shawl. Pocketses is the winner of some Rolegs that I have carded on my blending board. Winner number 3 is for post number 22, and that was posted by Libelina for the Crooked Cathedral shawl. Libelina wins a repurposed Starbucks coffee bags tote, generously contributed by Maggie of Maggie's Corner. Winner number 4 for post number 31 is Sally from Idaho, who knit up a beautiful Nymphalidia, which she called Hug for a Dear Friend. And Sally from Idaho is the winner of Happiness Temporary Tattoos from Tatley. Winner number 5 for post number 13 is Kay Connors, who posted photographs of an Oak Trail hat and a two-way shrug slash tank. Kay Connors is the winner of a set of beautiful bamboo crochet hooks contributed by Sherry of Spinner's End Farm. Winner number 6 for post number 11 is B Star Stuff for a gorgeous Tiffany shawl. B Star Stuff is the winner of a set of bamboo needles, also contributed by Sherry of Spinner's End Farm. Winner number 7 for post number 25 is Out of This World, who knit quite a few things for this craft along, but post number 5 featured an adorable Beyond Proporium sweater with really brightly colored buttons. Out of This World is the winner of a one-of-a-kind sparkly sock yarn from Zen Yarn Garden, and this was contributed by Cindy of Conversational Threads. Winner number 8 for post number 20 was Tanya 2000 for her very pretty brickless shawl. Tanya 2000 is the winner of a skein of laceway yarn in the Spring Leaves colorway, contributed by Susan of Riot of Color. If I have announced your Ravelry username as one of the winners of these 8 prizes, please send me a personal message on Ravelry and use winner in the subject line. Let me know your mailing information and I will be mailing your prize to you. Or in the case of Tanya 2000, I will be forwarding your mailing information to Susan so that she can get your prize out to you. Congratulations to all of our winners, and congratulations to everyone who completed a garment or accessory during our asymmetrical craft along. During my driving time this weekend, I was listening to U University's most recent episode. Oh, there's a hawk. Oh my goodness. Wow, I wish I knew what kind of hawk that was. There was a hawk just gliding along the river and took a perch in a tree on the other side. During my pretty significant driving time this weekend, I listened to the most recent episode of U University, and I'd like to recommend it to Yarns at Yinhu listeners, in particular those of you who participated in the asymmetrical craft along, because Chris, the host of U University, provides a really nice and well-researched mini-lecture on human aesthetic preferences, and she references asymmetrical design during her conversation on that podcast. I will provide a link to it in the show notes. ever-expanding skill set. This weekend, I had a holiday from school, which provided me with a bit of a long weekend, and I decided to visit my sister Jessica in Vermont. Rise Up Homestead, which is the name of her homestead in Vermont, is a post-apocalyptic training ground. Jessie and her man do without a lot of modern conveniences, and yet when I visit there, I am at my happiest and most relaxed. And when I returned yesterday evening, Samuel insisted that I looked younger and more beautiful than he's seen me in a while. Maybe it's the fact that I was away for 3 days, but maybe it's has to do with being truly relaxed and happy and getting to play with the dogs quite a bit. So I'll talk just a little bit about my visit, and then I will insert a recording that I did, a follow-up interview with my sister. Rise Up Homestead is near Killington, Vermont. It's at a rather high elevation. During the drive there, the view was pretty. Some of the trees have started to turn, but at the homestead, the view was spectacular, and there was a lot of fall foliage in color. The season has not been as dry in middle Vermont, and the colors were extraordinary, and the weather was unbelievably gorgeous. Highs during the day were in the high 70s, maybe even the 80s, and then as soon as the sun goes down, it does get very cold with a very heavy dew. In the morning, it looked like there had been a downpour during the night, but it was just a very heavy dew. The air in Vermont is crisp and kind of bracing when it's cool. It was just beautiful. I got to do a lot of playing with the dogs, Thoreau, who is an Australian Shepherd, and a black lab named Tula. I went on a long walk every day and even took a bracing swim in the pond on Friday morning. Part of my enjoyment of visits to Vermont has to do with the unbelievable cooking skills of my younger sister, Jessica. We had tacos with homemade tortillas. We had a gnocchi making party and had a variety of toppings fresh from the garden, with gnocchi featuring her gorgeous golden potatoes. And then we had a variety of roast vegetables, desserts, cookies, candies. She's just amazing. I can't keep up. And it was a good thing I took a long walk every day, because I eat about twice as much as I usually do. Jessie's harvest has been truly incredible. And she had just picked some of her last tomatoes when I arrived. We decided to work on a batch of ketchup, because that's kind of a long, engaging process, and it's nice to have an extra set of hands. I took a number of crafting projects along with me, but between the amount of driving that I had to do and my enjoyment of the visit, I did not get a lot done. Primarily, I was able to do some spindling while I was watching the ketchup cook down over the fire and keeping the fire going. I also started taking my spindling on walks, and so I got a little bit of spinning done while I was walking with the dogs. And in the evenings and the early mornings, I did a little bit more knitting on the Batad capelet by Stephen West that I'm working on. This knitting I did by headlamp, and that was a pretty interesting discovery, because the welts on that Batad are pretty challenging to achieve. There's not a very stark contrast between the two different color yarns that I'm using. And so sometimes it can be a little bit difficult to see where to pick up the purl stitches in order to create those welts. Having the headlamp was very helpful. So I recommend that if you're doing any knitting in bed or you're using dark yarn, even in daylight conditions, using a headlamp can make things a little bit easier. On the Yarns at Yinhu website, I have a photo essay of the process of creating ketchup. And the interview that I'm about to insert into this podcast focuses primarily on the process of making ketchup. So I hope that you enjoy it. And I hope you're inspired to do some cooking of your own. The Bulk Bins Cook Along continues for the month of September with barley. And then in October, we're focusing on herbs, seeds, and teas. And I hope to share some recipes from Rise Up Homestead with you.
Been almost a year.
Yes,
yes.
That's not your birthday weekend.
No, it's not.
But it's been almost a year since we recorded for the first time, and Yarns at Yinhu listeners fell in love with you.
Aw, thank you.
And I always get asked about your place in Vermont and how it's going. So I'm sure they'll be curious. 1 year has brought a lot of changes.
It certainly has.
When I interviewed you last, I think you had the propane stove.
I did, yes.
But you did not have solar power.
There was no electricity.
There was no electricity, and you had not yet wintered over.
And I was terrified. Yeah. I may have been hiding it quite well.
You acted pretty confident.
I was pretty worried.
But you had a very good harvest. You were proud of your
harvest. Yeah, I was talking about my bumper crop of carrots last year.
Yeah.
That was the big thing.
And so Mom and I visited you at the end of June. And we were both of the opinion that your garden was further along. And you seemed to have fewer problems with bugs and other things to contend with than you had the year prior.
Yeah, you know, we're expanding every year, and we added some new grow space and a new 40-foot high tunnel this year. And I think we're starting to learn about timing in this climate, and there's certain times of the year where you can attempt to plant something and it's useless because, you know, different bugs are out that time and they will just devour things as quickly as they come up. So we have given up on certain times, you know, and just work with the time frame we have instead of just struggling against it. That's made it a lot easier. It gave me more time for weeding. Why everything looks so much better.
It does. It looks, yeah, things just look fuller and happier. And we're recording this on September 26th. You've already had a killing frost.
Yes.
And you were able to salvage and cover and save quite a bit.
Yeah. Our one high tunnel, 12 feet wide by 40 foot long, that has tomatoes in it, now has a second layer of plastic with a small airspace between. And that survived the frost just fine. I went out there in the morning. Everything else was frozen. It was very cold. And it was warm in the greenhouse. So that was great. Those would not have made it otherwise. But everything else, we were able to cover fairly well. Semi-delicate things like the new planting of peas and second plantings of green beans, and then other things like carrots and turnips or cabbages, kohlrabi, and all of our hearty greens were pretty much fine without coverage. They suffered a little damage initially, but they bounce back as long as you get some good weather. So, yeah, stuff actually looks really good. We're pretty proud.
Overall, what are you proudest of or most pleased with your harvest this year?
I think... Well, I'm just so proud of everything. I think in general, we're the most pleased with the way these high tunnels we've been building are working out. We tried our winter squash as well as melons in a high tunnel this year, which we had not had previously. And they filled out a lot faster. We were able to monitor their watering because the plastic over top keeps them from getting rain, which in the past had been an issue with having the squash rot. So we water them with an irrigation system where they get the perfect amount of water. There's no rot. They didn't get powdery mildew. And so our crop of winter squash is amazing this year. Really good. And our tomato hoop house, I mean, same thing. Just really was a lot easier to manage. We have so many tomatoes this year that we've even talked about canning enough so we don't have to grow tomatoes next year except for fresh eating. Or maybe for selling. So I think,
that's an interesting proposition that you could take advantage of a good year and skip a year.
Because canned goods keep, especially tomato products, for several years. No problem. You don't have to worry about spoilage. And then we could use the greenhouse for something else. But I don't know, we're just really happy with the time and the money investment to build the structures. We're finding it's definitely worth it for extending the season and, you know, anything we can do to make it a little warmer, a little longer, or a little warmer at night gives us the help that we need. It's like growing in New Jersey.
So when I entered your house the other day, one of the first sights was all of the canned goods.
Oh, man. Yeah.
A few of the things. Pickled cauliflower, dill pickles, jams and jellies. We had some amazing tomato ginger jam with cream cheese and crackers. That is unbelievably good. What else have you canned?
A lot of tomato products right now. Crushed tomatoes, tomato puree, different kinds of salsa, Italian sauces. Working on ketchup right now.
We've been working on ketchup.
And I've canned a lot of jam this year, actually.
And you're growing some of that and you're foraging for some of the
fruits? It's foraged. We foraged for wild blackberries this year. Which we hadn't done last year, but we'd done in the past when we had time. And we probably picked, I don't know, 6 gallons or so wild blackberries. It takes a while because they're smaller than, you know, grown ones. But they're good, and they make great jam. And I made some raspberry jam from our raspberries, and black currants. That was a new jam I made this year, one of my favorites. But yeah, we also...
That's a very European taste, but I love it.
I do too. I was actually upset I didn't have more. After I made the jam, I thought I would have liked to have made a liqueur, which I've heard about doing with them. But yeah, pear jam. We even ordered a case of mangoes early in the season and made strawberry mango jam. Jesse's request. Which was phenomenal. Definitely worth the mango investment there. Cannot grow those even in the greenhouse.
So. And his request was also for ketchup with probably some of the last tomatoes that you'll have of the season.
Definitely the last that will ripen on the plants in the greenhouse. We should have tomatoes. If I do it right, we should still be eating tomatoes by Christmas. But those are tomatoes. They don't have the same flavor as ripened in the greenhouse. You know, I'm going to cut the vines early, lay them all out. They'll be green when I bring them in. And they will ripen and they'll be sweet, but it's not
the same.
It's not the same. No, you can still make tomato product, but it's inferior quality, I'll admit it. But we're desperate up here, so we do it anyway.
So let's walk through some of the steps of making the ketchup.
The dreaded ketchup.
We started with about how many pounds do you think of tomatoes, a variety of kinds?
I think we started with about 35 pounds of paste tomatoes.
Okay, so these are very high pulp, not watery tomatoes.
They're not watery. Some were really large and some were small, depending on the variety. So that's, you know, there's a range there, but definitely all pulpy. They should produce a good ketchup.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of cooking down.
There is. So we wash them in the sink.
Yep.
Then you had, what was the gallon capacity of that big pot?
I believe it's a 4 gallon, four or 5 gallon pot.
So you just slice them in half or in quarters, depending on the size.
Mm-hmm.
And then squeeze them a little bit with your hands as you put them in. Whole. So all you did was remove any blighty spots, any bad spots.
Any blemishes. If they have, you know, some of the heirloom varieties have cracking on the top, which can harbor, you know, bacteria. You cut that out.
But skins on.
Skins on. In cores the pot, in.
A little bit of water.
A little bit of water to prevent sticking because it's a big pot. It's hard to stir the bottom. But you could skip that if you wanted to avoid. I mean, you would have to do a little less boiling off if you didn't add water in the beginning, if you're making a small amount, but I just can't.
It prevents sticking.
Stir a 5 gallon pot of tomatoes without some water in the bottom.
And then that started on the stove, but then we quickly took it out to an over the fire boiling down process.
Part of what we love about our homemade ketchup is the smoky flavor, and you get that over the fire, and also making ketchup uses a lot of propane, so if you have an alternative cooking method, you know, you should use it. And we definitely have a good setup. We've got a great over our fire, and it works wonderfully for cooking it down. So, cooked inside a little bit, and we squeeze-o'd on a rickety table.
Yeah.
Outside.
And that removed seeds, skins, core,
any tough, hard bits, any green shoulders on the tomatoes.
Anything that would have been bitter.
Yeah.
And we ended up with a very big vat of pulpy juice.
Yes.
That went back on the fire.
Back on the fire. Cooked for a long time. I'm not sure. 6 hours?
6 or 8 hours, I think.
6, 8 hours. Oh, yeah, actually, maybe closer to 10 hours.
Before it was a small enough quantity that could come back inside over a low flame.
Yeah, and a heat diffuser plate helps here, too. Once it's thickened up quite a bit, past the sauce stage, it needs near constant monitoring.
Because the sugars start to concentrate themselves, and it's just thicker overall.
It's thick, and it wants to splatter. And it does, even with stirring. It's definitely messy, and just requires constant attention.
So it continues to cook down, but you've also added some things to it at this point.
Yeah, as it's nearing the end, you start adding your spices. And we did skip. I added an onion that had been cooked, chopped up and cooked in vinegar. And then I had run that through food mill to make a puree. I added that. You can add that early on. It helps infuse the flavor. But the spices and the sugars, you want to wait to add until the very end, as close to the end as possible, because they will increase the risk of burning. I added allspice, cinnamon, cayenne, powdered mustard, brown sugar, a little molasses, salt, and lots of apple cider vinegar.
To give it that tangy.
To give it the tang, and it also makes it a lot safer to can your tomato products.
So it adds that acidity to it.
Yeah, okay. So you don't need to worry as much about spoilage.
So maybe by this evening we'll get to be canning it, and what will be from about 35 pounds of tomatoes, you said?
Yes.
About how much ketchup will you put in jars?
About a gallon. About a gallon of ketchup.
How does that compare to boiling sap for maple syrup in terms of ratios?
Actually, this is a better return. This is a great return compared to boiling sap because it's between 30 and 50 gallons of maple sap to get 1 gallon of maple syrup.
Okay, so we're talking about 4 gallons to a gallon, so about right. A quarter.
Yeah, great return. See?
Great return.
It's not so bad.
See, it's looking up.
It's very approachable.
All that time spent stirring over the fire is looking up. When I taste this ketchup, I really, well, it's not quite ketchup yet, but when I taste this product, I really do get the smokiness and that depth of flavor, that kind of underbelly of flavor that's
the slow cooking. The molasses helps too, I will say. That's a secret. Secret ingredient just gives it that, the depth. And of course the smoke helps.
What do you do with all this ketchup?
Ketchup is...
It's a mellowing agent.
It's filled with mellowing agents. and it's good to get your daily allotment. We use ketchup on...
It helps you guys get along through the long, hard winter.
It's a long winter. In Vermont, it's very dark, and yes, it probably does. Also, it's just delicious, and we, besides from the obvious way, which is to consume our 325 pounds of potatoes as baked oven fries dipped in ketchup, which we
That's
do.
That's a good choice.
It's a good choice. Mm. Classic. Mm-hmm. We also use it, I use it in soup, to flavor soup. I use it in my chilies. I can use it like a tomato paste, which essentially is what it is. It's a highly flavored tomato paste. We were talking about earlier, I thought you could make a creamy tomato soup with the ketchup by adding milk. We also use it on our bean burgers, which we eat a lot of, and they need a sauce.
They need something. So, well, I think a lot of people think about ketchup, buying ketchup in the supermarket as a condiment out of the fridge served on something.
Right.
But you're thinking about it as an ingredient, a condiment that you can use as an ingredient to give a little more flavor and body to other foods that you're cooking.
Yes, it adds an extra dimension to anything you put it in. I mean, and you can't necessarily identify it as having been
ketchup.
Yeah. Baked beans. I mean, they love ketchup. And no one knows there's ketchup. You can't taste the ketchup, but it's sweet, it's tangy, it's sour, it's salty, it's all those things, and in our case, it's also smoky. And it's great in all kinds of stuff. Meatloaf.
Yeah, I like using it.
Why not put some ketchup in everything? It has natural mellowing agents, after all.
I think that's a good rule of thumb. Well, I was thinking when I was tending the fire about our conversation last year, and one of the things that you didn't anticipate thinking about so extensively was wood and kinds of wood and storing wood for the winter. There is still a lot of wood out there.
There's so much wood.
So how do you explain your wood use? Did you know you had more than you needed?
No, we didn't. We had never spent a whole winter here, and we'd also previously been trying to heat a house that was not insulated. We went into the winter with about 9 cords of firewood, and we probably only used 3.5 or 4. Our walls are very thick and they're very well insulated, and we just didn't need the quantity we thought we would. So this year is great. We haven't had to focus on it. We have cut more. You know, you want to stay on it all the time. But we're going to have really great aged firewood.
And you've even made a couple more improvements so that you might have... Yes. Even less need for the energy this year.
I think we probably will. Yeah, we've tightened up some windows and improved some of our siding and our crawl space. So all of those things have definitely cut back on what we need, which is great because firewood is a lot of work. And it gets so cold. I mean, you don't want to be... You can't skimp. There's no way to skimp. Or you'll just... spend the whole winter uncomfortable. So yeah, we were pleasantly surprised about how much firewood we did not use. It was great.
So were all of us in New Jersey. We were very glad that you didn't need all that firewood.
Everyone was worried. Everyone, that's the first thing they say. You're going to freeze. But I can assure everyone, we were toasty warm. We were so warm. We were sweating in here.
And it wasn't because it was a warm winter.
No, it was very cold. It was negative 30 many times. Wow. Horribly low wind chills. There was a ton of snow. It was considered to be a very harsh, very cold, very snowy winter. Wow. And we did not feel it in here. That's for sure. The sun was coming in, and it was great.
Well, Jesse, I want to thank you for talking with me again for the podcast.
Thank you.
And I wish you and Jess a very warm and happy fall and winter.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yarn Lover at Large. I departed from Vermont on Saturday morning, and on my way back to the Poconos, I stopped in at the Southern Adirondack Fiber Festival. This is held at the Washington County Fairgrounds in Greenwich, New York, which is north of Troy. It's a beautiful area with a pretty substantial farming and fiber farming community. And the festival is one that I highly recommend. There was a great variety of vendors. The fairgrounds were beautiful. The events were organized and well-labeled. Everyone was friendly. And it was bustling and busy, but it wasn't overcrowded. I will definitely be looking for ways to attend this festival again in the future because it was just a delightful experience. The fleece show and sale was one of my favorite aspects of this festival because everything was very well labeled and clear. So for someone like me who's kind of a beginner in thinking about fleece and fiber and considering an investment in the future, I learned a lot. It was clear who the winners were. The judges' remarks and scores were prominently displayed. Information about the breed and the name of the farm where the sheep was raised were clearly written. And the categories of yarn and the categories of fiber were very clearly marked. Everything at this festival was very clearly labeled. And so it was easy to maneuver. And it just was a lot of fun. A couple of things I did, not so much related to fiber. I had some amazing pumpkin ice cream. And I also watched duck herding. There was a really adorable Aussie named Summer who was herding ducks during a demonstration. And I included a photo on the show notes. And I also did some shopping. I had printed a list of vendors and marked some places I wanted to stop. And I will also link to these vendors in the show notes. Bat and Kill Fibers is one of the sponsors of this fiber festival, and I purchased some DK weight yarn from Mary Jean Packer, who is the proprietor of Bat and Kill Fibers. I also met Ginny of Fat Cat Knits. I had received some fiber from her as a gift from Lara, and it was so nice to meet her in person and see her fiber on display, and I took the opportunity to purchase some sock yarn from her in the Wayfarer colorway. Carol Ann Law was there with batiks and prints. I had first met her at the Rhinebeck Fiber Festival and made some purchases of Christmas presents there, so I continued that tradition and made a few purchases from Carol Ann Law. I think the name of her business is Amity Farm, and she does amazing batiks of mostly farm scenes. At least they're the ones that attract me. And then those batiks are printed onto tiles, onto paper, onto mouse pads, onto cutting boards. And they're all different sorts of ways that she sells her prints. Oh, also note cards. So that was a lot of fun visiting her. When I was buying my pumpkin ice cream, I was standing right behind Sister Mary Elizabeth from St. Mary's on the Hill. And this is a convent with a vocation of raising animals, specifically cashmere goats. So I purchased some cashmere yarn from St. Mary's on the Hill. I also spent a good deal of time talking with my cousin Lisa of Spinner's Hill, and she sells primarily fiber by the pound. She sits with her really awesome vintage Hobart scale, and she has a variety of dyed locks, dyed carded fibers, and you can just buy small quantities or large quantities, and she was doing great business the entire time. So we got to talk a little bit between her customers, and I also made a purchase of a rainbow of colored fibers for an upcoming class that I will be teaching at the Inner Space in Highland Park. I've designed a workshop for spinning the chakras, and during this class, participants will be focusing on the body's energy centers, and the way we will do that is by spinning rolags that have been custom blended for each participant. So I was in need of very specific colors of fiber to use for these rolags, and Lisa had an amazing array of colors. So I picked a whole bunch of things, and I will be using them to make some custom blended rolags for participants in this course. If you're interested, if you're a spinner who would like to learn a little more about spinning meditation, or if you're an uninitiated spinner and you'd like to learn more about spinning using a drop spindle, you might be interested in taking a class at the Inner Space in Highland Park. And I'll provide more information about that in the show notes for this episode. Christy, who is the host of these workshops and who has created the Inner Space for Creative Wellness, is offering a discount to Yarns at Yinhu listeners. So if you'd like to know more about the discount, you can send me a personal message on Ravelry. Double happiness. Since 1992, when I was a freshman at Centenary College in Hackettstown, New Jersey, I have been attending the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival. It's sponsored by the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation and has changed locations a number of times since its inception. This year it's being held in downtown Newark, New Jersey, which has an incredible arts and culture scene and a number of venues that are really conducive to listening to live poetry. The Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation and its poetry festival are one of the main reasons I've become attracted to poetry, certainly a contributing factor to earning a graduate degree in poetry, and continue to foster my awareness of poets and their work. And it's become a way for me to share poetry with my students. This year, the festival will take place from October 23rd to 26th in downtown Newark, as I said, and they have a teacher day with events primarily for teachers on Thursday of the festival, and a student day on Friday of the festival. I will be taking a group of students from the high schools where I teach on Friday. And right now I'm in the process of sending out permission slips and trying to turn students on to this idea that you can go and hear live poetry. The poetry and the poets who are there range from, you know, very traditional kinds of poets writing formal verse to spoken word poets reading in languages other than English, and they have translators. There's an incredibly wide range of poetry present at this festival. I encourage you to check out the website, attend if you can, and look for the dates and times for live streaming. I didn't see that on the website when I just checked it this morning, but certainly there will be information about a live stream a couple times during the festival. And this is a great way for you to listen in on some poetry if you are unable to attend. This year, one of my favorite poets, Marie Howe, will be featured at the festival. And today I'd like to share a poem of hers called Part of Eve's Discussion. Part of Eve's Discussion. It was like the moment when a bird decides not to eat from your hand and flies just before it flies. The moment the rivers seem to still and stop because a storm is coming. But there is no storm. As when 100 starlings lift and bank together before they wheel and drop. Very much like the moment, driving on bad ice, when it occurs to you your car could spin, just before it slowly begins to spin. Like the moment just before you forgot what it was you were about to say. It was like that, and after that, it was still like that, only all the time.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Chris DeLong and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a Sweet night thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Nature's ever get you high till your face is smile. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Yeah.